The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, a knock at the door changed Andreas Christofferis' life forever. In a case of mistaken identity, he was the victim of a vicious acid attack that altered his physical appearance and his entire world. He told me his story. Ahead of the publication of his book, The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America, CNN's chief White House correspondent, Jim Acosta, gave us an insider's view of what it's like covering the Trump presidency. Emma Breen and Sarah McGlysett came in to discuss the phenomenal creation that is Aisling. We laughed, and we laughed, and we laughed for about 30 minutes. You'll know why when you hear the interview, and you might even spot yourself in there somewhere. And part historical novel, part science fiction, and part village mystery, The Second Sleep is the new book from author Robert Harris. He joined me in studio to talk about the future and the past of humanity and civilization. That's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Until next time, thanks for listening. Almost 5 years ago, my next guest's life changed drastically simply by answering a knock at his door. Andreas Christofferis joins us now to share his story. Andreas, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's nice to talk to you. If you wouldn't mind bringing us back to December 2014, I presume a day like any other, maybe give us a run through what sort of a day it was for you.
So yeah, December 2014, started off just as another day. Mm. I was... at a time, very motivated businessman working at home that day. We're in the process of launching a new company, and it'd see me in my office 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, slogging it out. Mm. I still live in the same house. I live on a 1980s red brick cul-de-sac. Lovely street, nice road. Being on a cul-de-sac, you get to know the cars, you get to know the people that should be there. You just have a feeling and a knowledge of the road. I sat working in my office. My office looks out onto the road. And I noticed a red Peugeot Partner van drive down the road. And it caught my attention because it's exactly the same make, model and colour as a van which I own and use for work purposes. Mm. Quickly realised it wasn't my van and carried on about my business. Living in Cornwall, we are limited in what we can buy on the high street, so we end up buying a lot of stuff online. It's common to have couriers come to our house, you know, possibly a dozen times a week. You know, that people come and go very frequently. You don't think anything of it, really. Mm. About 5 minutes after seeing this red van, I had a knock at my door, went and opened it, as I would to any normal person. You know, we live in a nice area, and you don't think to check through a peephole. You don't think to check identity before you open the door. You just open the door. And as I opened the door, I instantly received about a pint of concentrated sulfuric acid to the face, whilst my attacker said, "This is for you, mate." I knew instantly it was acid. I'd spent a lot of my life working in the hospitality industry, working around swimming pools and so on, where obviously corrosive substances are used heavily. My T-shirt disintegrated from top to bottom, from my neckline down to the waist. It was just hanging off me like a waistcoat. And I think that was the determining factor of me knowing it was acid. My attacker, he was stood about 2 steps down from my front doorstep. So he threw the acid in an upward motion, covered my face, down my torso, obviously on my arms, especially where the T-shirt, which had turned into this waistcoat garment, was hanging on my arms. There's a lot of acid around there. Mm. But also there, because he threw it in an upward motion, the acid went up, it hit the ceiling above me and then rained back down on me. So I then had acid drips all down my back. I was living at home. My wife and my eldest son, my only son at the time, Theo, who was 80 months old at the time, and he... thankfully, he'd been up with a fever throughout the night. So he was in his cot. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm. My wife was in bed because she'd been up with my son throughout the night. And that's the first saving grace. They were kept out of harm's way. I yelled as loud as I could upstairs to my wife, called 999. Someone's just thrown acid in my face. She obviously, it's not something you expect to hear when you're being woken up abruptly. It took a couple of attempts to get it through to her what had happened. Mm. And I ran through the house to my kitchen and started dousing myself with as much water as I could, not knowing categorically that was the correct thing to do, but logically it made sense. And if I'd known what I know now, I would have got upstairs and got in the shower and stayed there until the ambulance arrived. When the ambulance did arrive, I managed to get in. Paramedics got me in the ambulance. I managed to reel off as much of my medical information as I could to them, or what was needed anyway. And the police arrived, and I gave them as much information as I could about this red van that I deemed to be a suspicious vehicle.
And were you, Andreas, if I may ask you, were you in considerable pain, or were you in so much shock it was hard to register the pain?
It's a bit of both, if I do say so. I've been asked so many times to put it into words, explain the pain. But it's inexplicable. We can't. It's like nothing I've ever felt before. It's, the closest way to describing it is it's as if someone's thrown petrol over you and then chucked a match. Mm. You're on fire, but there's no flames. My face and my eyes were burning so badly. I could still see, but my face was swelling up. There was no doubt about it. I could feel, I kept touching it, and it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But every time I touched it, it just felt like dead meat. It didn't feel alive. It didn't feel like mine. It's the worst pain I've ever felt, and I'm sure it's probably the worst pain I'll ever feel.
The police had information on the attacker, and he was arrested, David Phillips. He lived 300 miles away from your house, a painter and decorator, as it happens. But their initial suspicions, Andreas, really focused on you in the middle of all that had happened to you. They were looking at you, and maybe tell us a little bit about that, about how it all proceeded from here.
So, yes, David Phillips was arrested before I woke up from a coma. The information that I gave about this red van was correct, and the police managed to trace it back to Phillips and Hastings. Mm. From day one, the police were very good to me. They said two things. We are going to get your attacker, and we're going to get the evidence why. And secondly, they said they strongly believed it wasn't mistaken identity. They were adamant I'd done something to warrant the attack. And that in itself was challenging, very challenging, because the police are there thinking you've done something to warrant this attack. So they dissect your life in every single way possible to try and find a reason why. And it started off when I was in an ICU, and I have very little memory of this happening, but they have a protocol where if they think you're going to die, they come in and get as much information out of you as possible. And I remember two police officers wheeling in this very archaic looking bit of recording equipment. That's mostly what I remember, to be honest, with this ridiculous bit of recording equipment that came in that's bigger than a suitcase. But then from then on, it's, our house got taken. We weren't allowed in our house. The cars got taken. Sat-navs, phones, iPads, computers, laptops, email accounts, Facebook accounts, eBay accounts. Any digital account you had was gone. Everything you owned, gone. Everything was then under the powers of the police. And I'm everything from personal to business. They all our company files. We gave them access to our solicitors. They had everything, and they were adamant I'd done something to warrant this attack, but they couldn't find a reason why. And it took some time for them to come round to the fact that, okay, maybe this was mistaken identity.
And in the middle of all of this, you were trying to come to terms with your new physical reality, and which must have affected every aspect of your life. I mean, whatever about the physicality of it, I presume sleep wasn't part and parcel of your night.
Sleep was torturous. So my injuries, it's a big difference with acid attacks. Two main injuries to focus on: burns and scars. Burns are what happen initially. when I eventually first saw myself in the mirror, which took some time to get to that point, I didn't look too bad. I was burnt. I had a red face. I was scabby. You know, they'd shaved off all my hair, but scarring hadn't taken on. You know, and it's the scarring which causes the disfigurement, and that can take weeks, months, or years. The biggest issue you have with scarring is tightness, or in more extreme circumstances, contraction. And the scars on my face contorted so much that it pulled my eyelids down and my top eyelids up. And over time, my mouth's been pulled out of shape, my nose has been pulled up, and everything's been disfigured from the scarring, not from the burn, so to speak. But I lost my eyelids 3 times, where they had pulled down away from my eyes, away from my eyeballs. You know, your eyelids serve a purpose. They clear the tear film, they protect your eyes. I didn't have that. I had no way of closing my eyes. I had no way of escaping the dark. No way of escaping the lights. You know, you can be in the darkest room and it still not be dark enough. Not having eyelids is torturous.
It's just the assumption, the arrogance of health. You know, you assume everything, don't you?
Yeah, you really do.
And tell me about Theo then, your son. We'll come back to the case in a minute, but just, you know, his dad has now been transformed physically. He's still the same dad who loves him and is loved back inside. But from the outside, a very different person is coming home. Do you recall that time and the difficulty of the almost having to reintroduce yourself?
Without a doubt. Until that day came, until meeting Theo, that was the biggest challenge. Not anything else. It was, how would Theo perceive me? Would he recognise me? Would he be scared of me? Would he think I look like a monster? You know, you spend a lot of time lying around in a hospital bed thinking, you know, and you create these, the more you think about something as negative as that, the bigger a problem it comes. The more you think it becomes a monster, the more you think about the monster, the bigger the monster becomes.
Yeah. You catastrophize, don't you?
Yeah, and that's, you know, it was my biggest fear. It was, you know, I guess a lot of people would be the same in that position, but for me, I was so focused on it, it got bigger and bigger and more problematic. Me and my wife made a decision very early on that he wasn't to come near the hospital. It wasn't a place for him. He didn't need to see what was going on. There was far too much, you know, on top of my injuries, far too much commotion, far too much the police always around. All these negative things he didn't need. He was with family members. He had food, water, toys, and love, and that's all he needed to get him through the time. Yes, he should have been with his parents, but that couldn't happen at the time. My wife saw him regularly, but I obviously did not. When I was out of hospital, several months after the attack, we couldn't be in our house. There was the investigation still going on. We were residing in a secret location, so to speak. And my wife went and got my son, and she brought him down to see me. My family, who I was with at the time, stayed in the house, and I went outside, them respecting what I needed to do on my own. My wife got him out of the car, and he took one look at me and just clung onto my wife and buried his head into her neck. And my heart sank. My whole, everything which I had, you know, built up in my head, the monster that I've been battling with for so long, became reality. And it was the toughest emotion I've ever had to deal with. Yeah. But then when I started talking, then when I just made conversation, trying everything I could, he knew it was me straight away. Yeah. And he stuck his arms out and gave me a gigantic hug. He hugged me for almost an hour that day. And he's never hugged anybody. He's not a huggy baby. he just isn't.
That is the greatest
feeling in the world. A rollercoaster of emotions. I've never felt anything like it.
It's incredible how a child can sniff out the authentic and the beautiful, the beauty within.
He never batted an eyelid after that. Yeah. It's bizarre. He now, being older, being six, he knows everything. We've ensured with professional advice, you know, that he knew what happened and the reasons why. And now he gets a bit uneasy if we go to the park and people are staring. Like, sure. He does care more now, but for years it didn't bother him. He didn't even notice.
And Andreas, let's return to the case because, as you say, everything was taken from you because the police were convinced that you had something to do with the case. And that all changed, obviously, when the detectives called you and said, we need to come and talk to you because we have there have been developments in the case. And this must have been a day to savour too.
So we had several of these meetings where senior officers from Devon and Cornwall Major Crimes would call us and go, we need a meeting. And you go, yeah, we could have something. And these meetings were dead ends, so to speak, on so many times. So it got to the point where I had accepted not knowing was a most probable outcome of the situation, and if that's how I've got to deal with things and move on, then fine, I will accept that and move on. And I was in this position of acceptance, really. My family weren't, God, they were almost definitely not, but I had to be to move on. I wasn't going to be held back. I couldn't do it. So yeah, they called another one of these emergency meetings, expecting it to be another non-meeting, so to speak. And they sat down and go, we know why, and we have the evidence to prove it. Which that was another insane emotion. I didn't know how to digest it. I just remember screaming at the top of my voice. Like, it was a strange, strange day. You know, I was happy, but God, I was angry at the same time. I did, you know. Just an emotional volcano. Didn't know what to do.
What door had David Phillips, the attacker, meant to knock on?
So David Phillips, he drove 300 miles to Truro from Hastings, and he believed he was taking revenge on someone who had sexually assaulted someone he cared for. He was supposed to target someone who once lived on the same road as me. He turned up at the wrong house. Oh. But even if he'd turned up at the right house, he would have still got the wrong guy because the guy who was his intended target had moved on.
Good Lord. And he pled guilty, sentenced to life, minimum of jail for 8 years. And you passed him by at one point and he made a gesture. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, he pled guilty, although we weren't overly excited by the guilty plea, if I'm honest. We wanted to go to court, knowing that if we went to court, a lot of the information about the attack, about him, who he was, would be made general public, general knowledge, and it was not because he pleaded. But yes, that day after he had pleaded, we walked back into the courtroom, and it's the first time where I had actually seen him face to face. And you walk past the glass cubicle that they keep him in, and I stopped and looked at him, and he signaled to his heart. And I just shook my head and walked on. It was irrelevant. There's nothing he could say to me that could change any of this. There just isn't. You know, his barrister did offer to write a letter to me at one point explaining himself, but I can't see me being any better off for it.
And where is he today?
He is currently residing in Her Majesty's prison service somewhere. He was originally sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8 years. After that sentencing, so that was sentenced at Truro Crown Court, we appealed to the Attorney General, and on the longevity of the sentence, 8 years didn't seem right. He should be in jail for longer. That was our general view. And I believe there's close to 70 appeals of the same nature made to the Attorney General. Someone from the AG's office phoned me up and said, look, the judge acted fairly. It was in line with other case law. Your appeal isn't to be granted. Unbeknown to us at the time, David Phillips had appealed the life aspect of his sentence. And frustratingly, his appeal was granted. So at that point, you'd already kind of, well, this is over. And then all of a sudden you're going through the appeal process and it's not over and it's been dragged out even longer. So I made a point of going up to the appellate court, High Courts London, with the senior police officers from Devon and Cornwall Police. I wanted the judges to see me. I wanted them to see the injuries. I wanted them to see firsthand the damage he had caused. We were the only people sat in a room that day. And I've since learned it's very rare for a victim to go and sit on an appeal case, but I wanted to be there. And that day, three of the highest ranking judges in this land, deemed him not to be a danger to society, deemed him not to be a dangerous man, and lifted life from his sentence, lightening his sentence to 16 years, of which he'll only serve 8 inside, which means he'll be out in 2022. And there's no doubt I'll still be having surgery for years to come, and I'm potentially facing a future of blindness if my eyes deteriorate further.
How do you feel about that?
I feel the system's broken. I feel that a lot of people expect me to be angry towards my attacker. He did what he did. It's nothing changing that. But the judges had the choice, you know, and the fact that they deem him not to be a dangerous man, and they deem him to be okay to be walking the streets when he took actions into his own hands in the way he did and made such a mistake of it, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, that's the bit that frustrates me more so than anything else. The system's not working right.
What's the biggest change that's occurred to you, apart from the physical, the obvious physical changes? What has all of this experience done to you in your heart and soul, Andreas, as a person, as a dad, as a husband, as a man?
Oh, I'm a different person.
Are
if you? I'm honest. I was once asked recently at a charity event if I could. Was giving a talk and I had a Q&A afterwards, and they said, I was asked if I could choose my life now or choose my life before the attack, which life would I choose? And I couldn't answer the question. It left foot in me and stumped me. Life is good now. It's very different. I'm a different man. I spend a lot more time with my family. I do a lot of charity work. I still run my own business. I don't work in the same capacity as I used to. But things are good. You know, I was reminded that the world is full of good people, I think. I had a huge amount of support from family and friends, but strangers from around the world. And it made me, I guess, look at the world slightly differently.
It's funny because when I knew I was going to be interviewing you, and then I saw in the paper the Joe Brand, the comedian, you know where I'm going to ask you now. She said the line about throwing milkshakes at Nigel Farage. She said, I'm thinking, why bother with a milkshake when you could get some battery acid? And I would have thought, oh, that's quite funny. And then I'm talking to you thinking, is that funny now, or do we, do we have dark humour, or what do we say about that?
Reckless comments by Joe Brand. Mm. I think any person who has a large following, and let's face it, Joe Brand is a very successful presenter and comedian, she should know better than to say things as reckless as that. I get comedy's comedy. I've laughed at lots of acid attack jokes.
Have you?
Yeah. One of my favourite comedians, Jimmy Carr. I remember being lying in a hospital bed listening to Jimmy Carr. I listened to a lot of Jimmy Carr when I was in hospital.
Yeah.
And he's got several. And I'm sat there going, oh, this is a bit awkward.
But why is Jimmy Carr's acid gag funny and hers isn't?
I think it was on the platform it was said.
Right,
whereas
right.
Jimmy Carr's is a targeted audience. You know, he's speaking to a room full of people. Whereas I think when it's on national radio, national TV, I think it carries further weight.
Yes, yes. You're an ambassador now for Face Forward. And you know, we have people in this country who will be familiar with that charity. And I presume, I suspect that it's good for you. It's something you enjoy doing, that you're not, you haven't decided to hold yourself up at home and not get involved.
Not at all. I've done a lot of work for charities since the attack. It's, you know, it's a way of paying it forward, and that is what Face Forward are about. You know, they help people. They specialise in facial reconstructive surgery for people of violent crime, and they're all about paying it forward. And they're a fascinating charity. Generally, are a fascinating charity. They've opened my eyes up to a different world. And you know, I've met people from scenarios from all around the world that they've helped, and each time I'm just jaw droppingly shocking the lengths they go to help these people around the world. Like, what's Face Forward have helped me with my surgery. I'm actually flying out there tomorrow morning for my next round of surgeries, and it's the golden ticket scenario for me. I firmly believe there isn't a better surgical path forward for me in my recovery. Even I had a bottomless pit of money, I believe this is the best thing for my recovery. And it's great to be involved and to be an ambassador for such an amazing charity.
It's good to hear, Andreas. It's really good to hear you being so positive. Your story is extraordinary, and I can only wish you and your family all the very best into the future, and maybe we'll cross paths sometime. But I can't wish you enough good luck, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Andreas Christophorus joining us this morning with that story. The text number 51551.
Well, it's all go in Washington in the past 24 hours as President Donald Trump loses yet another high-profile staffer in the form of John Bolton, the national security advisor who resigned and yet was also sacked in that Trumpian way. And one man at the media frontline last night and in recent years indeed is CNN's Jim Acosta, who has written a book I devoured recently. It's called The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. Jim joins us now. Jim, a very good morning to you.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Are you surprised, Jim, that sales of George Orwell's 1984 have gone through the roof in recent years?
I'm not surprised. We noticed that phenomenon as Trump was coming into office. And listen, I mean, this is a situation we're grappling with here in the U.S. in terms of how to cover this presidency. The Washington Post recently concluded that the president has uttered some 12,000 false or misleading statements since coming into office. I've put this metric in my book, but when my book was published, it was only 10,000 false or misleading statements. So you can see that that number is going up at a pretty rapid rate. It raises all sorts of questions. Do we call the president's false statements, falsehoods, lies? In many cases, they are lies. But you hear a lot of critics. You see a lot of critics out there on social media saying every time we should call it a lie. So, you know, this is stuff that we're running up against on a daily basis, just how to cover what is really a strange and surreal presidency at times, especially when it comes to the dishonesty. So I think that's a very fair question.
And again, just keeping with the Orwellian theme just for a moment before we delve into the body of the book and the presidency. In the last 10 days, even sitting with my 20-year-old daughter on the couch saying, you need to watch this. And she said, what? I said, look what happened with the Sharpie and Alabama.
Right.
If you put that into a little context for the Irish listeners who might have missed that story, and again, echoing the Orwellian sentiments, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a fascinating example of what we're dealing with. In just the last 10 days, we saw Hurricane Dorian. It was making its way towards the United States. And on Sunday, September 1st, the president put out a tweet saying, you know, watch out, Alabama. It's likely to be hit. But at that point, the National Weather Service was, putting out forecasts showing that the storm was making a right turn and heading up the East Coast. It was not threatening Alabama. And so the president's information was outdated. I don't think he intentionally wanted to say that Alabama was going to be hit. He was just wrong. But in the days that followed, he just didn't want to admit it. And what we saw over the course of the next, 9 or 10 days is the president very likely using a Sharpie to draw on a map to show that the storm was heading towards Alabama. That was a map held up in the Oval Office. And people inside the administration essentially being thrown under the bus. A top Homeland Security advisor put out a statement saying, oh, wait a minute, I was the one who briefed the president before he said that. And then the people at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, put out a statement essentially saying that, you know, the president wasn't that far off. And so, you know, this is a sign of where things are right now with the Trump administration. The president's dishonesty and deception is bleeding down into much of the administration. And you're seeing pressure being put on government officials, people who are supposed to be working on behalf of the taxpayers, to essentially fall in line. And that gets back to 1984, George Orwell. He warned us about all of this. And it puts, you know, journalists in a position of having to not just report the news, but defend the truth.
Which brings us neatly to the very present day. But I want to bounce back to where it all began. And arguably, it all began with what we now call the mainstream media. We're definitely part of it here in this organization. You're definitely part of it in CNN. And the idea that, you know, like the song said, they all laughed when Columbus said he'd find America. They all laughed when Trump said, I'm going to be president. And there was almost a sort of a smugness, maybe an arrogance to it. There was definitely a supercilious feel to it. And laughing the man off the agenda entirely. You know, do you see that now in retrospect, Jim, and sense that there was a miscall?
I think to some extent, yes. And I will say during the campaign, you know, I was starting to take his candidacy very seriously and thinking at the very least he could win the Republican nomination. I was pretty convinced that he was not going to win the presidency based on that Access Hollywood video coming out. I thought that was essentially it for his candidacy. And so did people inside the campaign. You know, there's that moment I talk about with Ryan Priebus, the former RNC chairman, went on to be the White House chief of staff, essentially saying, you know, it's going to take a miracle for us to win, said that to me right before Election Day. But, you know, yes, I mean, the Democratic Party put out a statement as Trump was getting into the race, mocking his chances. And I think what a lot of the so-called experts in Washington, the conventional wisdom types in Washington, they were essentially caught napping. They did not see what was coming, and that there was this very big populist wave in the making. And I will tell you, I go to these rallies to this day. I wasn't at the one last night. I was at the one in Manchester a couple of weeks ago. The president, despite his problems in the polls right now, still commands a very potent and very, revved up base that wants to get out there in 2020. So anybody who writes him off now, I think, is mistaken.
So when he started to march into the White House, and much to everyone's kind of shock, I suppose, in some ways, he got elected. You covered the Obama administration, and we'd see you on CNN, but we didn't necessarily know you as such. Trump comes along. He's utterly compelling. In fact, so much so that the mainstream media, again, so-called, really broadcast all his rallies, more so than probably others, because it was so engaging and such great showmanship. It was like P.T. Barnum with a rosette. And yet, for all of that, possibly added to his free publicity to get him elected.
I think to some extent, I think that's a valid question. I will say, because I do get this question from time to time, and I like to remind folks, listen, Donald Trump was essentially the GOP frontrunner from the very beginning of this race.
Yeah.
And so, for the mainstream media not to cover the GOP frontrunner as the GOP frontrunner is sort of, asking us not to cover the first place, New England Patriots, asking us to cover them less than the other teams in the league. I mean, that is just not going to happen. But I do think, yes, I think moving forward, you're going to see the coverage change a little bit. You're going to see a lot more fact-checking done. You're not going to see these rallies covered end-to-end live,
right,
as we did in the past. And you're going to see fact-checkers come on after these rallies are over to say, this is what the president got right, this is what the president got wrong. And we at CNN just recently hired a fact-checker named Daniel Dale from the Toronto Star, who's very popular on social media. And he writes up a fact-check that runs after these rallies are over, and is very prominently featured on our website and featured on our programs. And so I think you're going to see the coverage change as a result of what we now know. But as you know, hindsight is always 20/20 with covering politics. But I do think moving forward, the consumer of information also has to be savvier. I mean, something has to be said about, people finding information, finding stories on Facebook, that their Uncle Fred may send to them, coming from very suspicious accounts, very questionable accounts. Mm. People have to understand there are a lot of bad actors out there, people who are not part of the mainstream traditional brand name media, who are in some cases seeking to intentionally mislead the public for the political gain of certain actors out there, foreign and domestic. And so, we all have to be savvier, I think, heading into 2020.
When you challenged the I think it was president-elect that time, It was at that story, and you became the story, you shared the story, let's say, with the president because of the nature of the exchange. I mean, what happens in give us like a sense of that press conference, Jim, if you wouldn't mind, in the sense that, like, do you find yourself frustrated and almost furious, or where are you at when you take on the president? Are you nervous about taking on the commander in chief, because he is also so to be respected, and there is that sense that, it's never quite as belligerent, if you like, or certainly as feisty.
Yeah. Well, I describe it as a question of what would you do, and I write about this, throughout my book. But going back to that January 11, 2017 press conference, you have to remember the president was, taking a story that CNN had reported that the Russians had compromising information on the president-elect, and he was describing that story as fake news. And it was a situation where he was, essentially saying up was down and black was white and real was fake. And I remember just sitting in that, that press conference area right in front of him, I'm just astounded at what I was hearing and getting pretty angry about it. Because keep in mind, during the campaign, he called us the dishonest media, the disgusting news media. He called us scum and criminals and all sorts of things. And we had, you know, Trump supporters coming up to us in our so-called press cage and screaming traitor in our face and that sort of thing. And so, by the time that press conference came around, I just remember feeling kind of ticked off and thinking to myself, wait a minute, he's not letting me ask a question. He's going after our news organization. I felt like it was incumbent upon me to try to interject and get my question in there. Now, some people may say that wasn't the right call, but looking back, I feel as though I did the right thing and I would do it all over again. I felt that our news organization needed to be defended, but at the same time, he was just not answering the question. And as it turns out, the question that I wanted to ask that day, which is whether or not the president's aides or associates were in contact with the Russians during the campaign, was very much a real news question. As we found out, as time went on, there were contacts with the Russians, and it became a huge story here in Washington.
And moving to the White House briefing room in November 2018, and again, yeah, another contretemps with the president over the Russian investigation. How do you feel when President Trump is, excuse the word on this, sort of baracking you and hectoring you, and saying, you know, and then you find yourself fighting back, almost like having a row in a bar. Is that difficult, or is that now just the nature of the job in 2019 or 2018 as it was then?
Well, I think he, as we argued in my press pass case in federal court, he encourages this rough and tumble environment. Sure. And so for the White House people to express, to clutch their pearls and express shock that a reporter would interject and try to interrupt the president when he's berating them is a bit much. And, and I have said that to them privately, like, wait a minute, he's the one that's doing the interrupting, not us. And as a matter of fact, as I put in the book, I try to do this not to bore the reader, but to enlighten the reader. I include some of the transcripts from some of these exchanges. So you can see, I get about five or six words out of my mouth and he's already interrupting and berating us, So as I said before, it goes back to a question of what would you do? Do you just sit there and take it? Do you let the bully beat you up at the playground? Yeah. Or do you try to get that question out? And if it means talking over the president and, you just try to do it as politely and respectfully as possible, call him sir, call him Mr. President and so on. But you got to get that question asked, or otherwise, why are you there in the first place? If you're just there to be a potted plant, well, anybody can do that. I feel as though, it's important that these questions be asked. But one of the things that you have to remember about that November 2018 press conference, the thing that really got him upset was I was challenging him on this falsehood that there was a caravan, this caravan of migrants heading towards the border with the U.S. from Central America amounted to an invasion. And remember what just happened in that El Paso mass shooting.
Yes.
The shooter wrote in his manifesto that he wanted to stop a quote-unquote invasion of Mexicans coming into the U.S. So I defend that question that I asked back then, and I still think it's very important today.
An intern of some description was taking the microphone from you to say, thank you, Jim, you've had your question sort of thing, time to move on. You were accused of saying, standing your ground. That became a kind of a tussle, and then it was a battle to get to the fake news first in some ways.
Well, my feeling about that whole situation was, and listen, people can say, well, you should have handed over the microphone. I understand that. My attitude at that point was, whoa, wait a minute. Why is somebody coming after my microphone? This has never happened to me before. This shouldn't happen. But look what happened after it all ended. They announced that they were taking away my press pass, and then they tried to justify what they were doing with a doctored video. We get called fake news all the time. This was the White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders, tweeting out a doctored video showing me karate chopping this intern, and they removed the audio of me saying, pardon me, ma'am, to try to justify what they were doing. And so, going back to George Orwell, that was the most Orwellian moment I had ever experienced in my career. And so, it is, it almost feels, like we're in a sort of news battleground covering this administration. Yeah. Sometimes they are coming after us in ways that, it could result in the ends of our careers. One of my colleagues, Brian Karam, his press pass was just taken away, and a federal judge had to order the White House to give it back to him. And so, we're up against some circumstances here in the U.S. that we've never seen before. And I think, when you go through them on a daily basis, you can address these questions 10 different ways. But my sense of it is that the best way to take on this administration when they come after our First Amendment rights is to stand our ground. And really anything short of that just invites the administration and future administrations havoc on the First Amendment.
When the president's at those press conferences, I haven't seen him doing it as much of late, but there were times, Jim, when he'd say things like, you know, that's enough, you know, quiet, you know, that sort of thing that a really horrible teacher at school might have said to you in the 50s.
Right.
You know, how I watch you as journalists and kind of one to another from a distance thinking, how is your blood not boiling at being spoken like that in such a demeaning, public, I don't know if spiteful is the right way, but it's just pretty cruel looking.
Well, you have to understand a lot of it is tactical. And, you know, it works. It's very effective with his base, you know, over the weekend, just going into the weekend because of this controversy over the storm, Hurricane Dorian. The president tweeted out a video that showed a CNN logo crashing and burning and being lit on fire. This is the president of the United States doing this sort of thing. And, you know, what we have to recognize is that, you know, he thinks it's tactical and his political team may think it's tactical to go after the press because it fires up the base. The thing that I write about in my book and the reason why it's also titled A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America is that many of the president's supporters don't understand this. They're not in on the act. And that's why, you know, a lot of this hostility, a lot of this rhetoric is absorbed by his base of support. And it, at times, not all the time, not by everybody, but at times it is directed back at us in ways that make us feel threatened. I've received dozens of death threats. You know, the man who sent the pipe bomb to CNN tweeted death threats at me before he sent that pipe bomb to CNN. And, you know, it was tweeting things that, you know, included some pretty graphic images of violence and so on. And so, you know, what we have to recognize is that this is a very unusual presidency. The president has decided to go after the press in ways that we've never seen before in our lifetime. But that doesn't mean we back down. That doesn't mean that we let that go unchecked. My sense of it is that the only way to deal with it is to make sure they understand that we find it to be unacceptable. And as long as we're doing that in a reasonable, professional way, sure, yes, it's tempting sometimes to lose your cool, but I don't think that's going to serve our cause very well. I think we have to, you know, try to keep things on an even keel and just make sure that the public understands that this is not acceptable.
I was watching your colleague on Reliable Sources on Sunday recently, and he was saying that there hasn't been a daily press briefing at the White House since March the 11th, an extraordinary long time.
That's right.
You outline in your book fascinating exchanges, both verbally and through email and so on, with Sean Spicer and indeed Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Now you have no one to go to, but you do have the president standing for some particularly peculiar and kind of irritating reason beside a helicopter at full tilt waiting to take him off. I mean, it kind of adds to the bonkers nature of the world we live in. And, you know, but he gives a lot of access at those, incidentally, but it's just the noise. How are you on that? I mean, are we getting, has the president and the chopper press conference and his constant tweeting replaced essentially the press secretary's role?
It really has. You know, this is by design. The president has decided he doesn't want to see briefings anymore, not by the press secretary. Now, they've replaced that with a lot of, what we call sprays with the president, where we'll go into the Oval Office, or we'll be standing by the helicopter as he comes out, Marine One, and he'll take some questions. But as you said, that chopper is roaring and you can't hear the reporter's questions. You can just hear the president's answers. So you can't hear him evade our questions. You can't hear him tiptoe around what we're trying to get at. That's all by design. And so I don't describe it as access. I describe it as contrived access. It is access in name only, because we don't have those press conferences where the reporter is mic'd, where the reporter is on camera, and you can see and hear the questions. And people may say, oh, that's just because you want to grandstand and get your airtime and so on. Well, no. I mean, people can say that, and that's fine. I suppose they could say it's their opinion. But I think it's just as important for the viewer, for the listener, to see and hear the questions so they can see whether or not they're being answered. In a lot of these cases with these press briefings, a lot of times it's the way they don't answer the question, the way they refuse to answer the question, they avoid the question, that speaks more to what's happening in the world than when they do answer the question. I think sometimes that's even more revealing.
Just as you're talking, I'm just reminded of when the president looked up to the sky and said, "I am the chosen one." And I was kind of shaking my head going, is it possible to move into another realm? And my question to you is this then, in the coverage of it all, are you ever concerned that you and your colleagues in the mainstream media, and I say that, quote unquote, are playing into his hands, that you're a gift to him, ultimately. You know where I'm going with this, and that his base are fired up by your line of questioning and modus operandi, etc.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I understand that question, and I understand that concern. Mm. If somebody could build me a better mousetrap, I'm all ears, believe me. But okay. In the meantime, you know, people will say the same thing about the tweets. Should you cover the tweets? Well, you know, when the President of the United States tweets that members of Congress who happen to be women of color should go back to where they came from, that's news. When he describes Baltimore as a rodent-infested city, that's news. When he describes the chairman of the Fed as an enemy, that's news. I don't know how else to cover that besides to cover it.
The chairman he appointed, incidentally, isn't that it?
The chairman of the Federal Reserve that he appointed, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, when it comes to these questions that we ask, you know, I'm just trying to think of what the world would think of the United States if, you know, all of us in the press corps sounded like a bunch of Stepford wives, you know, saying to the president, "Oh, you're so wonderful, Ms. President," you know, like something out of North Korean state media. My goodness, I think the rest of the world would just look at the United States and gag and wonder what in the world is going on. And so I think the public, I think our friends around the world, they expect the press to hold the president's feet to the fire. It's expected. And I think the moment that stops, you're going to have a lot of people around the world wondering what has happened to the United States. I suspect, you know, that is going to be going on well after Donald Trump has left the scene.
My last question to you, Jim Acosta, this morning is, that you described the erratic nature of President Trump's press conference at the G7 summit to being like a cat chasing a laser pointer. And with that in mind, do you believe that this cat will chase that laser pointer all the way into a second term or not?
I'm out of the predictions business. Let me put it that way. I didn't think he could win after everything he went through, but he proved a lot of us wrong. The same states that were critical the last time around, keep your eye on this time around: Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. All of those states right now, the president is deep underwater in the polls. He would have to reverse some major trends in order to get a second term. The other thing that he's running up against is an economy that is looking increasingly unsteady. The more the economy looks unsteady, the longer the prospects are for the president. And, you know, Americans, it's a tradition in this country, they vote with their pocketbooks. If there's any sense that this economy is starting to weaken, that is going to make things even more difficult for this president. Typically, when the economy is doing this well, when the unemployment rate is this low, you know, like Ronald Reagan, they're usually cruising into a second term. Mm. But George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, you know, he in large part lost due to a recession that was coming to pass here in the U.S. And so we're just going to have to wait and see, I think, how this economy does. But in the meantime, I was proven wrong the last time around. I would say don't count Donald Trump out heading into 2020. You know, one of the things that he has done in this country rather successfully is build a base of support that we really haven't seen, I think, since the 2008 days of Barack Obama. And that is still a potent force to be reckoned with. And I think it gives him the advantage heading into 2020. But there are some major headwinds, no question about it.
Who is the Democrat best place to beat him?
I would just, you know, turn to the polls and say that Joe Biden is probably best positioned. And I wrote about that in my book, that had Joe Biden been the nominee in 2016, I think there's a very strong chance that Joe Biden would be president right now. If there continue to be these questions about gaffes and misstatements and getting a little foggy about, you know, his memory here and there, that has a way of chipping away at a candidate's support over time. It's kind of a death of a thousand cuts.
Sure.
But if Joe Biden can address that, I think he's well positioned to take on Donald Trump and potentially beat him. And we have not had a one-term president since George H.W. Bush. So it's been about, you know, 30 years now. It seems that the country is due for that statistically. But, you know, as I said before, I'm out of the prediction business.
That's for sure. Well, I can understand why it's a messy business. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this morning. I really appreciate your insight on all of the above. And congratulations on your book, which will sit up probably beside my copy as of this evening, 1984 by George Orwell as a salutary reminder of the curious nature of the world. Thanks for your
That's
time.
Good company. I'll take it.
You got to take it. Absolutely. Thanks a million, Jim. Nice to talk to you. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. CNN's Jim Acosta there is the author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. It's a super book. I have to say, I enjoyed it from cover to cover. Gobbled it up. If you like American politics, you will not be bored. And you can follow Jim. He's on Twitter at Acosta. All right. That's Jim Acosta. What a fascinating insight into intriguing times. The text number 51551. Yeah. We're back. I love that. Sarah's going, do you know they do Grand Flu? I said, did you not hear the top of the programme? What's wrong with you? In studio this morning are the writers we call the Ashlings, such as the phenomenal success of the character they created many years ago while recovering from a night out in their shared accommodation. And here we are, recovering from yet another night out together. It's Eimear McGlice and Sarah Breen. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
We were actually tucked up in the bed at 10 p.m. last night.
Lies yeah. going around.
That is no, there's no lie there because they have beds in the Stella Cinema.
They do.
Very so, comfortable.
You were tucked up there, quaffing cocktails at 10 o'clock. So yeah, you weren't telling a lie necessarily. Are you still wearing your
we're
wristband?
We're still wearing our
downtown. We don't have the strength to pull them off.
As I was saying, has there ever been anything as incongruous as a Downton Abbey wristband?
They're both wearing Downton Abbey wristbands. Do you know what they look like? It looks like the band you wore when you were born in Holly Street.
We've been reborn this morning.
Here we've been, reborn.
Please welcome Born Again Christians, Eimear McGlice. You're wearing Downton Abbey wristbands.
We didn't have the strength to rip them off this morning.
The shame.
You're such media creatures, aren't you? I mean, you know, I thought I was bad, but you're like...
Oh, we were lapping up the free drinks last night. I'd say. Loving it.
Aren't those wristbands really hard to get
they
off?
They are really hard to get off, yeah.
We've no strength this morning,
Did
Ryan.
You try putting them...
It used to be Electric Picnic wristbands. Now it's Downton Abbey wristbands. How things have changed. Are 100 years old.
So you went to the film last night. It's getting kind of funny reviews, but we were saying this morning... We reckon it's the kind of film that on a Sunday afternoon, you just want to go.
Yeah.
It's extremely cozy.
Like, absolutely
cozy.
Nothing happens in it. But it's beautiful. I still enjoyed it.
But nothing happens beautifully.
Oh, yes. Oh, and the clothes and everything. And our nerves were at us yesterday, and we just needed something really relaxing. Yeah. And we were like Downton.
Yeah. And how's Lady Mary? And she?
Oh, as cold and brilliant as ever.
Yeah. As cold and brilliant
as ever.
Yeah,
she looks fab. Yeah.
She's very. So today is Ashling Day.
Yeah.
I mean,
self-proclaimed.
Yeah, it's a national event now.
Okay, let's think about this for a second. On O'Connell Street, where you'll be later on in Easton's, right? You across outside Easton's, you'll see Daniel O'Connell with bullet holes and bird droppings. You'll see further up Jim Larkin with the hands out going, I can't get a bus around here, whatever we say. Further up, Charles Stewart Parnell.
Yeah.
Now let's imagine we place a statue of Aisling, right, between them all. What's she looking like? What's she wearing?
She's wearing her jumper.
Yeah. Which is...
She's wearing her what?
Her jumper.
It's a shirt-jumper hybrid.
So handy.
For convenient. So it's where your shirt is kind of sewn into your jumper.
It's really just the collar and the cuffs, isn't it? And the bit at the bottom.
Yeah.
What colour is it?
Oh, a pastel.
A muted. Very muted.
Okay. And then she'd have maybe like a sensible pencil skirt on the bottom.
Yeah, and definitely a pair of runners.
Mm-hmm.
It depends where we have her. Do we have her walking to work?
If she's walking to work, she's wearing the runners. If she's in work, she's probably changed into the shoes that are under the desk.
The court shoes.
Yeah,
the court shoes. Now, if it's a modern statue, would she have the battered old BT's bag in her hand?
She'd be lost without it.
With the other...
with the lunchbox or the pair of shoes.
Either a Brown Thomas bag or a bag from The Loop. From where she from where she did the 4 days in Malaga.
The quality of those bags is second to none. They'd last a lifetime.
David Attenborough's not a fan of them. Now, if she has the bag, right, and depending on which shoes, so she's wearing the court shoes, the runners are in the bag, the runners, the court shoes are in the...
This
in
is
the,
it.
Okay, got it. You mentioned her lunch. Is it in Tupperware?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Now, what? It's the seriousness with which we approach it, but we are building a statue. So what's in the lunch box? What's in the Tupperware?
I would say a Slimbo, which is a kind of a, no offence to Slimbo, it's kind of a grim sandwich.
It's like a bread substitute almost.
Make one for us. In the air.
It's a kind of a kind of a roll, but a sad roll that's kind of...
It's very low in calories.
She's watching her figure. Ashling's always watching her figure. But so there's a Slimbo and it's in the Tupperware
box.
What's
in it? What's in the sandwich?
Ham. Slices of ham.
Is it butter? Is it mayonnaise light? It like diet
low
mayonnaise?
Low.
Maybe a Brady's ham if she's a Kildare girl.
She'd have to go
like
Brady's.
Myself.
Yes.
A bit of lettuce. Not okay. Too much.
Okay.
Nothing mad.
Does she treat herself at all? Is there popcorn
oh,
or
gotcha.
A sort of a,
oh,
a sort
popcorn,
of a foamy
Manhattan
dessert?
Popcorn. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe a yogurt. Controversial.
Would it be a yop? Would it be a yop in there?
It might be a yop. It could be a Grand Falou. Who knows? A Mother Light.
Maybe a packet of Velvet Crunch.
Yeah.
Great. That's the lunch sorted out. How's her hair?
It's natural colour. She's never dyed it.
But she's hitting 30, so do we have greyness? Or?
No, not yet.
No, she doesn't have to worry about
no,
that.
No, she's not
yet.
Worrying about that just yet.
Okay, and is it ponytailed up or is it
bouncing on her
shoulder?
It'd be a sensible low ponytail.
Yeah.
Nothing fancy.
Yeah, now if she was going out somewhere, she might give it an LGHD curl.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. Okay. And you see that bounce for the special occasion.
Yeah, it won't last, the poor Ashley.
is that bounce gone by midnight or is it gone
definitely,
by the next day?
Long definitely. Gone. Her hair will be limp by midnight.
Okay.
Poor Ashley.
We're really dragging her.
We're painting this glorious picture. Can I ask you about her makeup? Is it well applied or is it fake tan or where are we on that?
It's minimal.
She goes au naturel a lot, doesn't she?
She does. She wouldn't be into the fake tan now.
Oh, God, no. It smells like biscuits. She wouldn't be. No, she. There's too much potential for things to go wrong with fake tan.
Yes.
And maybe a little bit. I don't know. She's just not really into it. She's envious of people who can apply it properly, but she's never been one of those people.
Okay. And then
I'm just describing myself here.
Well, there's a lot about. We could get into that.
Listen, we can't throw stones.
No, indeed. Not in this studio, anyway. And when she goes home. I would often think of people who go home for the weekend.
Down home
from Dublin. She goes, you often think of Maeve Binchy's Lilac Bus, you know, that sense that, you know, the adventures of people and you might meet strangers on the same, but obviously times have changed now. So how's Aisling getting around in terms of going home? Are we training, busing, getting a lift? Is it carpool? Where is she at?
Aisling is more than likely driving the Micra down home.
Extremely sensible Japanese
extremely
car.
Sensible. Back in the day, she probably would have taken maybe a JJ Kavanagh's or the equivalent.
Of course,
That was kind of when we came up with the idea for Aisling. I was travelling up and down home every weekend on JJ Kavanagh's Rapid Express.
Yeah.
And that was where we saw a lot of Aislings.
Yeah.
And I was going up and down the N7 in the Micra. Still at that.
But it's funny, when I mentioned David Attenborough in passing as a joke, you guys are kind of anthropological hunters. I mean, you're sitting on the bus going, here she is, the lesser spotted Aisling, wearing jeans of a certain type.
Bootcut.
With a makeup, a bootcut. You see, straight away. Okay, so as you describe your creation, I'm feeling that Doctors Frankenstein are kind of taking the mickey out of the monster. In other words, how do you feel about this creation? You're kind of... You're a bit sniffy towards her.
Oh, no, we love her.
Not at all.
No, you're like,
we are Aisling, that's the thing.
You're like mean older sisters towards her.
No,
you are.
She is us.
She's not you. I can hear your tone. I can smell your tone.
Because we're such Aislings, I think we get away with being affectionately slaggy towards her.
I'm not buying
that. You're going to have to buy
it. For one second. I think, you know, you're saying you're such Aislings now. You've outgrown the monster. And now the monster is...
Please stop referring to Aisling as a monster.
No, but in terms of the Frankenstein analogy, that's all it is.
Yeah,
obviously, she's not a monster. She's
I would
our
say
friend.
It's actually the opposite. I'd say when we first started talking about Aisling, it was a bit more, us and her. Whereas now she's been very good to us. And we have now written so much about her. She's grown from just kind of a one-dimensional, you know, girl with the BT bag to a girl with a life and family and love.
That's a very fair defence of your stance on it. So let me suggest then that if you saw somebody be mean to Aisling, you would be like you would jump in front of her and say, "Don't you
take a bullet
alone.
For Aisling?" Yeah.
That's what
we?
I'm thinking.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, absolutely.
Okay, you've brought me around on a coin. That was quick.
Sold.
There's a great line and a great sense in your books, all three of them, of this thing. They're so distinctly Irish, and tapping into a type of Irishness, and not just these aren't books for women, by the way, they're for all of us.
Yeah.
Because the humour is gender blind.
Yeah.
But with this in mind, you have this sense, like, which I love, is about notions. This Irish word, it's not an Irish word, but it's a word that belongs to us. We've appropriated it. Tell us about this sense, because I've been talking to a lot of people. Ard Lohanan was sitting where you are now, Emer.
a few weeks ago, and he talked about life in the 80s. And he said, when his mother cooked lasagna, we weren't allowed to talk about it in case people thought we had notions. Right? So tell me about notions.
It's just a sense, it probably does come from somewhere maybe deep in the 80s or beyond, a sense that if anyone had anything that was a bit better than yours, then they had notions and they were to be distrusted.
Yes.
So even when I grew up, a neighbour who maybe had a second car before anyone else definitely had notions.
The glamour.
The second car.
Or
my husband is from Dublin and he recently suggested that having salami in a sandwich was like a school lunchbox staple. I was like, what? We didn't get salami in Carla.
I remember someone told me that they had hummus in their lunchbox in the early 90s.
And you would think there was somebody in their box going, Like, there was no way you thought
it was
food.
I was in college when I first had hummus.
I can remember the day spaghetti bolognese came to Kildare.
On a chariot.
It was definitely the 90s.
Can I just say, I've never had hummus.
What? It's delicious. No lumps in hummus.
There's our notions now.
I've never had a hummus or couscous.
But yeah, Aisling would have been very sensitive to people who have notions. And again, when we first came up with her 10 years ago, it would have been a big part of her kind of personality, would have been noticing people who were a bit above
her
station.
When you say she's sensitive to it, she spots it and says, your one's a bit and your man's a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe it's a flaw of hers that she can be a bit judgmental about people who have, you know, that she perceives to have notions or have ideas above their station. But sure, we all are sensitive to people who have notions.
you've got to keep, you know, it's called a wing clipping, isn't it? There's a bit of that. The Taoiseach invoked Aisling at one point not too long ago. John Boyne, the great Irish author, described her as the real voice of Ireland.
I know.
Why has she got this traction with us? What is Aisling, who I now feel is in the third chair here, in a really affectionate way? I kind of had this
She's a big fan, Ryan.
Actually, I believe you're mentioned in this book.
Do you think I didn't go straight to that reference?
In the same sentence as the Pope, I believe.
Why are you laughing?
Oh, no, joke.
Thank
there.
Thank you. I could sense that I almost like. It's like when a character's so well sketched and drawn out, I bet you guys would love to meet her for a drink.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be great. She'd mind her handbags as well.
Yeah, she would.
Is that not a bit sad?
No, she's great crack, but then she will mind the handbags and she will text you when she gets home.
She's also minding her own handbag. So, I mean, always. She may as well look after the other handbags at the same time. But
where are you going when she's minding the handbags? And why isn't she with you?
It depends if we're out.
Aisling was out and a few of her friends were maybe smokers, disgusting habit Aisling has never imbibed, she would definitely mind the handbags. Or she just, even people mightn't be leaving the table where they're having the drinks, but her eyes are constantly making sure.
And is she doing it like is she being Matt Talbot job? Like, is it the martyr and I'll look after
the bag? No. Everyone has a friend, I think, who minds the handbags on the night out.
The bag handler in
some sense. And who reminds everyone to have a glass of water between drinks.
She's just innately sensible.
Yeah. Is that mammy-ish?
It's just sensible.
Maybe a bit, but not in a bad way.
When does she let loose? Where's the crack?
Oh, loads.
The dance floor in Coppers.
Well, what turns her on in an artistic sense? I'm not talking about the other.
The first few notes of C'est la vie by The Witch.
That'll get her going. Any of the Galway girls?
So that's Ed's and
Any of those. Caledonia. She loves a bit of that.
Yeah. Oh, she likes it with the kind of hand to the ear sort of. Let me tell you that I love you.
Yeah. This is it.
Being with the girls, having the crack, having a glass of Pinot Gris on a Thursday night.
Doesn't even get the full title.
Yeah, she's not a square. I think, you know, there isn't really a misconception anymore, but like some people might think, oh, she's a bit of a square. She's not. She's
great crack.
Yeah.
Samantha in Dublin wants to know, what would Aisling have to say about children having sushi in their lunchbox? Because it's happening.
Well, we've already mentioned notions, and I think that is notions of the highest degree. That's not happening. I do not believe
it is happening.
Putting raw fish into an enclosed Tupperware is not something Aisling would be involved in, I don't think.
It takes in the early noughties, the pasta aisle in a supermarket in Mullingar was called the ethnic food aisle.
Sounds about right.
Complete notions. All right. I absolutely love the Aisling books, says another text. They're so pleasantly readable. I loved the piss catcher shoes on the boys. I never look at men's shoes the same way. As we were talking about shoe and polishing earlier on, would you just explain to our listeners about this, this particular footwear?
This might be a type of footwear you might find on a man, particularly in the Midlands. It's brown. It kind of turns up a bit at the toe, which is how it earns its name, the piss catcher.
And what does he wear with them, Emer?
A pair of bootcut jeans.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Thank and you. A check shirt.
You'd call it a going out shoe.
A going out shoe. So, what about the brown shoe and the navy suit for fellas at weddings? Are we? That's quite a common.
It's all the rage now. Yeah, I think it's actually the law. I was at a wedding at the weekend.
Law. Yeah,
it has to be
a waistcoat ever so slightly too small.
Yeah,
makes you feel a bit nervous looking at it, like those buttons are going to go any second.
You're all over this. I love it. On my first visit, says a text, to Donegal in 1968, I went to the local grocery and asked for yogurt. Try the chemist. '60s notions.
So yeah, we were saying it was in the 80s. Back in the 60s, those notions got up with notions. The yogurt.
Richard's on to say, I'm splitting my sides on the Lewis listening to the two Aislings. That's good. You know when somebody's listening, you see them on the
chortling away.
I like that. I'm always wanting to go up and say, what's so funny?
Yeah.
It happens a lot now when you might see somebody in a quiet office and somebody's roaring laughing with the headphones on. You're going, what is it? Yvonne, our colleague and friend Yvonne Killen has been on to say, I'm weak listening to the girls on the radio. I have a cool pack in my lunch bag today to keep my Tupperware cold. I have never felt more seen.
Wow. A cool pack.
A cool pack.
But it's not even a Monday. Like, that's a very Monday lunch thing to be doing now, getting very organised on the Sunday night.
It's not even warm.
It's Thursday and she's got a cool pack.
Notions.
Yeah.
Maya Dunphy, another good friend of ours, says, I'm loving the girls this morning. Hashtag grandfaloo. Hashtag Aisling Day. You know the expression mad for road?
Yes.
Again, a quick definition of it being?
Mad to go out. A goo on the lash.
On the lash, mad
for road.
The goo is another great one. Be fierce goo on me. You know that? You know it's going to be a long night then. Do the Germans get that when they're reading your book? Or is it really an expat
actually
thing?
Mad for road is one of the expressions that we that the translate. So our book has recently been translated into German, the first book.
Yes.
Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling. And we got an email last week from the German translator.
God love her.
She was like, I'm very sorry, but I have a few queries. Mad for road, what does this mean?
Well, yeah, you'd say to her, well, you know how you feel after editing our book,
now you're mad for road.
What else had her bamboozled? Oh, so the concept of wearing a pair of O'Neills, which for Irish, particularly women of a certain age, is a pair of navy tracksuit bottoms. Yeah. So the German translator was like, What are you talking about?
Yeah. I know. The other thing is that, of course, at one point you had to replace Francis Brennan, featured in the previous book.
Yeah.
And you replaced him for the UK audience with?
I think, was that Philip Schofield?
Yes, it was.
Yes.
It was Philip Schofield.
We struggled with who to replace him with.
He has no equivalent.
No.
Internationally.
You're so right, Sarah. He's in a league of his own.
He's a hotelier with the sheets and the travelling.
So we went with Philip Schofield. We were just kind of like...
People love him.
Somebody mams like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And every time he comes on the Late Late, people love him.
Yeah.
Oh, like, he's very lovable.
My mother, says a text, had a favourite saying about a woman in our town who wore very high heels and very red lipstick.
Oh, what's she up to?
The comment was... That one always had notions of conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's in fairness, your mother was quoting a generation, arguably. Love the Aisling book, says Gemma, and how she never misses the hotel breakfast. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
That's really... I mean, the hotel breakfast stops at 10. You wake up generally in hotels after a night on the terrace at about 2 minutes past 10. So what are we doing there?
Not if you're Aisling.
Yeah, we're setting our alarms to go and get the hotel breakfast.
So, but Aisling must, she's been drinking water, so she's been sensible all night anyway.
Oh, she sometimes lets it slip at the end. I mean, she's not infallible.
Yeah, I mean, the water drinking might go on till about 11 and then she's on the dance floor, so...
If she's at a wedding, there's going to be Jager bombs.
Yeah.
But she will not miss the hotel breakfast.
No.
And when she hears the opening bars...
It's included in price,
Ryan. You paid for it.
What's wrong with you? You flahoolock fool. I'm just thinking of the opening bars of Come On, Eileen.
Oh, yeah.
That must do a job for her.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Sure, look, she'd have the flip-flops on at that stage.
Oh, she transfers the shoes. Gotcha.
Crucially, you never take off your shoes before the bride does. That's one of Aisling's rules.
Aisling has standards.
That is great. I mean, this is the etiquette of it all. It's intriguing. As 30 looms for her, she's written, she had this list of things that she wanted to achieve by that age, including her marriage to
to John.
To, but well, actually,
Shane Filan.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
It's like, yeah, correct answer,
Prince
Sarah.
William.
Yeah, okay. So Shane Filan. So this is, gives us an idea of where she is pop culturally and all the rest of it. But she's chief bridesmaid to her best friend. This description of the bridesmaid trying to get this organized, this hen party in Tenerife, right? The WhatsApp group. This is the language, again, of a generation. Talk to me about just the cluster cuss, as the fantastic Mr. Fox would call it, of trying to, of being the chief bridesmaid for a hen party with WhatsApp group and strangers. That is just a horrible cauldron of
it
of,
is,
of
and things. Women have to deal with this every day, Ryan.
Yes, I know, that's what I'm trying to feel your pain.
Yeah, so you're bringing together all these different groups of people.
Sure.
So you've got your family members, you've got the mammies, you've got the mad friends and everyone, and you're putting them into the WhatsApp group and you're trying to get the deposit for the accommodation out of them. So this is what Aisling is doing when she's organising Magella's hen in the new book. It's a nightmare, isn't it, Emer?
She has to set up the WhatsApp group. She has to confirm who's coming, who isn't coming. She has aunties, you know, who don't understand the concept of airports.
It's like they forget. Yeah. It's
and
so funny.
She has, as Sarah said, mad friends who just want to go on the lash.
Can I get my own room?
Yeah.
Extra bag?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the weather going to be like?
Can you make sure it's warm? You know, this kind of stuff. So,
and Aisling, you know, can handle anything.
Yeah.
But even this gets a bit too much for her. We found out she's not infallible when she has to deal with all these women. God love her.
God help her. Okay, text. It's so good to listen to the girls having lots of laughs from a proud Carlo woman. That's
yes.
a few minute mags. English vegetarian friend asked for a vegetarian burger in mayo in the 90s and got a pineapple ring in a bun. I love that. Mary was on to say, I was in an Australian airport last year reading what a complete, oh my God, what a complete, Aisling. When the lady beside me turned to say, I've been trying to work out what on earth is an Aisling. But now, you know, we've been discussing her at length for the statue that they're going to make for her. I asked for ice in a bar in the west of Ireland in the early 70s. And I was told, where do you think you are? The Savoy? A friend's mum in the 70s used to do halved grapefruit with brown sugar and the shining cherry grilled as a starter. Notions. And Mary says, oh God, I just realised I'm a complete Aisling.
We get that a lot.
You must get
yeah,
that a lot.
We get that
what
a
do
lot.
They do? They come up to you and say, I'm her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's
I'm
okay.
Her.
And are they? Do you recognise the Aisling in them?
Yeah, well, everyone has a bit in them. Definitely.
Absolutely.
And anyone who says they don't is lying.
they're in denial.
Yeah.
Okay, there's the last time we spoke, there was talk of a movie. That's still in the mix, I take it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Element Pictures.
Yeah, we're working on the screenplay to turn our first book, Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, into a movie. We just did a draft a couple of weeks ago and sent it in, and we have another one due at the end of October.
Yeah, and then they're getting really serious about it, and they're talking about directors, and they're talking Great. About maybe filming next year, and
casting.
It's all very exciting.
Exciting. Yeah, yeah. So, do you know what? You deserve it all, because you just came up with this wonderful characters and creature, but character, and from the crack we were having this morning, you can tell that people are just have warmed to her too. So it's great. So well done. Congratulations. What's happening today? You've got a big thing in East St. Connell Street today. The first 50 real Aislings will get what?
They'll get a copy of the book.
Yeah.
Actually, they'll get all three books.
Yeah.
This is the third book in the series, obviously. They'll get an Aisling tote bag. I think they're going to get
the very
special Aisling scented candle.
What is it? Is it like a scented candle?
It's the scent of the sea, I believe.
We've already had several people this morning. So people who pre-ordered the book from Easton's got this fancy scented candle. And I would say at least a handful of people have already been in touch to say they will never be lighting it. It's like the millennium
yes,
candle. It will
yes.
sit on the mantelpiece and never be lit.
Okay, but you have to have a photo ID if you...
to prove that
your name
is Aisling.
But so we'll accept any spelling variation.
Yeah.
Oh, very good. So if your name is Aisling and you just get to Easton's today between 12 and 1, meet Emer and Sarah, get the book. But more importantly, don't mind the book, get the candle.
Yeah.
Get the scent.
Get your free candle.
Somebody wants to know, what would happen if Aisling met Ross O'Carroll Kelly and Cobbers?
Ooh.
Well, I think Ross would fancy her.
Yeah, I think he would too.
Yeah.
She's a beguiling woman.
She is.
She really is, isn't she?
What would happen? I'd like to think sparks would fly.
I'd like to think that sparks would fly. Now, rugby wouldn't necessarily be Aisling's sport of choice.
He could talk her around.
She's a proud country woman, so she's seen the matches. But yeah, he could definitely talk her around.
You're living the dream.
He could talk anyone around.
You guys are living the dream. I love it. Thank you so much for coming to see us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
I really enjoyed our conversation. Once, twice, three times in Aisling. It's her party and she'll cry if she wants to, from Emer McGlycett and Sarah Breen. Wonderful stuff. And as I say, if you want to get along to Easton's on O'Connell Street today at 12 o'clock, you can meet the gang themselves and get your book signed. So onwards and upwards. Continued success.
Thank you.
It's going to be a long day for you guys. Yes.
Now it's 9:23 this Friday morning. In his career, Robert Harris has sold, we reckon, about, what, we're on 10 million novels, Robert, at this point?
Absolutely no idea, Ryan, to be honest.
Ancient Rome, alternate histories of World War II, modern political intrigue, and now he's back with a novel and certainly unexplored territory in The Second Sleep. I think The Second Sleep brings up everything. It brings up Brexit. It brings up, even though you wouldn't have known at the time necessarily that he was going to be PM, but Boris. It brings it, phones, communication, all of these things. Here's my question, and I was intrigued to ask you before when I finished the book, was what are we to do, you and I, now with regard to talking about your book and the twist?
Well,
do we give the twist away now and get on with it?
I think we have to, Ryan, to be honest. Otherwise, we can hardly talk about the book, and then it's rather frustrating for the listeners, I think. So the reviewers have given it away, so let's give it away.
Okay, so there's a pause there for people who, if they don't want to know, can disappear for the next little while. But in the meantime, I don't like reading reviews. I want to read a book cold. So I didn't, had no idea. I was lured into it, and suddenly in this, what are we out, what year was 1468.
1468.
I thought, God, this is a period of history now that doesn't really do it for me. I hope it's interesting. And suddenly a parakeet appears, a grandfather clock appears, some communication device. And I was thinking of something like the Rosetta Stone or something with the bite of an apple out of it. And I thought, where is this going? Talk to us.
Well, the idea behind The Second Sleep is a title, you know, in pre-industrial times, people used to sleep twice. They used to go to bed early, wake up about 1 a.m, get up, socialise, eat something, and then go back to bed until dawn. And that struck me as a perfect metaphor for what I was trying to write about, which is that the world has lost its technology and that some cataclysm occurred. And the book is not set in 1468, it's actually set 800 years in the future, after our technical civilization has collapsed. And it's about a priest and an antiquarian and a couple of other characters who set out to try and really, like an archaeological dig, to find out what became of us. We've left some ruins behind. We've left motorway bridges and embankments and cooling towers, concrete cooling towers. We've left a lot of plastic bags and straws,
nappies.
And wipes. But we haven't left any really great buildings, because all these great modern skyscrapers and so on will collapse within 100, 150 years. The modern houses around churches will collapse, but the stone-built churches will survive. So the world has gone back to a kind of medieval, religious-centred existence, but there is this overhang of what became of us, and the whole discussion of science and technology has been outlawed by the church.
What an intriguing premise. I'd love to know, was there one trigger for it, Robert, or was it a series of events?
I think it came to about 6 or 7 years ago, the idea, because I'd written the Roman novels, and I thought it'd be quite interesting to write about people trying to find out about some lost civilization, and it turns out to be us. So that was the starting point. And then I think I got very alarmed about our dependence on the internet and the digital realm, how much of our economy, knowledge, if you think of us at home, how many of our photographs and our videos and our lives are in this thing called the cloud. And if something went wrong with it, we would be lost. Most of us don't know how to read a map anymore. We rely on satellite navigation. And so that became my calamity. So now I had the two things, the idea of people looking into the past and the thing that had happened to us.
And so in the book, they have this almost ye olde world. They're speaking in a language that is
from the King James Bible. Yeah.
Right. And you're not allowed, is it, talk about or refer to or get involved in too much excavation of the past 800 years ago when it was 2012 with this arrogant, or 2019, I should say, with this arrogant generation or arrogant people?
I think hubristic, actually. I mean, you know, the taking the symbol of the bitten apple, which is a symbol of terrific heresy, and, you know, and using it from the Garden of Eden, you know, that the serpent, you know, they eat the apple and then they become too aware and calamity follows. So the fact that Apple should have taken that as their logo, put it on every device, it strikes my characters 800 years in the future. It's just an incredible illustration of arrogance. And
I made no correlation to the biblical reference, but it makes great sense.
So they and of course the world has gone back to the King James Bible, and there are no words for technology and computers and so on. Yeah. So the church, rather like the party in 1984 with Newspeak, the language controls the thought, and there aren't the words for the world as it used to be.
I spoke to CNN's Jim Acosta this week, and we began our conversation by talking about 1984 by George Orwell. Why is there an Orwellian shadow cast over this modern period of our history?
I think because it's such a brilliant book, he nailed certain things, which is just sort of universal, and the surveillance society, and the idea that you can twist truth. I mean, it's all about fake news, really. It's 2 + 2 = 5.
You're right.
If the party says that, that's the truth.
Yeah, and if a Sharpie pen shows it covers Alabama.
Exactly.
The storm's coming for Alabama.
Yeah, don't argue with it. The only thing that he got wrong, I think, which is one of the things that in the Second Sleep, is that the church, Evelyn Waugh wrote to him and said, I really think your book is great, but there's one mistake.
Yeah.
You miss out the church. And ignore the supernatural element if you want. As an institution, I don't think it would disappear in the way you obliterated it in 1984. I think that's true. And so in my novel, the church is central once again.
There's a piece in it when Shadwell, who's the great heretic as well, he says, we all know that almost every person, he's referring 800 years into the future, back to now, that every person, including children, was issued with a device that enabled them to see and hear one another, however far apart in the world they might be, and that these devices were small enough to be carried in the palm of one's hand, that they gave instant access to all the knowledge and music and opinions and writings in the world, and that in due course they displaced human memory and reasoning and even normal social intercourse, an enfeebling and narcotic power that some say drove their possessors mad, to the extent that their introduction marked the beginning of the end of advanced civilization. It's a beautiful thing. Talk to me about that paragraph.
Well, I think that, I mean, I'm quite serious, to be honest about it. I think it's changed who we are and how we interact with one another. I think in particular, you could notice it with your kids. The anxiety that's spread by social media, the lack of attention span. It's no accident that the purveyors of this narcotic, you know, the bosses of Silicon Valley don't allow their own children often to have these devices, you know. They're like dealers in crack cocaine who, you know, they live in the smart end of town and they're prepared to sell it to others. So I think it is quite dangerous. I mean, there's obviously wonderful benefits from it, but the power of this thing we carry around with us, which we call a phone, but it isn't really a phone, is it? It's 10 times, 100 times a phone. Is changing the way we interact with one another, possibly the way we think, and it's undermining all our institutions and our democracy. You know, the idea of commonly shared facts, agreed facts, which is the basis of a democracy. Because we all have our own little device now, we can all get the news we want. We simply don't believe the other side, whatever they say. And that is doing a lot of damage as well, I think.
Your father was a printer, is that right, in Nottingham?
Yeah.
And he came from a generation, I think, because we were talking about this a bit earlier on, about self-sustaining the consumer society, pick it up, throw it away, filling land banks full of clothes we don't need and so on and so forth. And he would have been able to strip down the engine of a car and put it back together again without thinking or blinking. Probably could do a lot more besides.
Yeah, and a lot of dads, you know, when I was growing up, they were all you saw was their feet poking out from under the car
all
weekend.
They knew how to do stuff.
Yeah, they knew how to do it, and they had to do it because they didn't have the money for anyone else to do it.
Correct.
My mother repaired clothes and that sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't, as you say, a disposable society. People could function and had to because they hadn't got much money. Nowadays, you couldn't even possibly begin to repair a modern car because there's so much electronics in it.
Now, and again, equally, that comes down to clothes or fixing, you know, the fridge is broken, get a new one.
Yeah.
You know, rather than tinkering.
Yeah, your fridge is a computer linked to the internet. Yeah. I mean, it's a very... And all this is fine as long as it works properly. But if something was to go wrong with it, we could be in a lot of trouble. And we know, actually, states are planting viruses in one another's systems as a form of cyber warfare. And one of the things that the Brexit debate has brought home to people in Britain is how this just-in-time supply, you know, that your supermarkets are, they don't have a big warehouse attached to them. They're just shelves. And all the food is in lorries on the road. So any interruption to that, a huge city like London is said to be six meals away from starvation. You know, and the average household now only contains enough food for about 2 days. We used to Deliveroo and all these sorts of things. So we're really dependent on this technology, and any interruption to it, just imagine in your own life within 72 hours where you might be.
But we watched the news last night, and Yellowhammer's... Well, I mean, that extraordinary
document.
Could
have called the book Yellowhammer,
You could
Hammer,
have called
actually.
The book Yellow, the second hammer. And you really could, because you saw the trucks, and they're saying, if those trucks don't come and they don't go, and the next thing you know, it's food shortages, civil unrest. Like, language I had to second... You take a second look at.
Quite. The first paragraph in this book has the word curfew in it.
Right.
And actually, the British government is talking about possibly introducing a curfew. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. You know, it's unplugging yourself from the modern world. They've made the discovery, astonishingly, that Britain is an island. Yeah. Who knew?
You know, there's something else, and we'll come back to all of that, the politics of that, but the Roman trilogy, among my favourite books, captures that what we can only imagine was the sense of the greatness and the grandeur of Rome. And even still, I was there during the summer, the Roman Forum, and you have to close your eyes and smell the dust and the heat and try and picture the majesty of it. But we have brittle buildings left behind as a reminder of what was amazing. Do you see a correlation between the extraordinary nature of ancient Rome, the aqueducts, the viaducts, the innovation of buildings and roads and so on, to our cyber version possibly of what they did, and then with that the fall of ancient Rome and the potential collapse of this arguably hurtling towards a more hubristic end?
Yeah, I mean, you know, civilizations come to an end. They all do. The Mayan civilization in Central America collapsed. It had 40 cities in Central America, and it disappeared within a generation. Nobody knows why. The Romans, Rome was sacked in 451 AD, and they withdrew the legions from Britain. And the ruins were still visible 300 years later of the great villas and so on, but nobody knew how to make them work. Nobody knew how the central heating worked. Nobody could. The roads were no longer being maintained. The paradox is that because the Romans built so brilliantly of stone and concrete, that what they left behind endured. And so, actually, if you go to Rome, the Pantheon still stands after 2,000 years, and modern civil engineers are not sure to this day how they built it.
Colosseum,
the Mulvian Bridge, where amazing. Cicero arrested the Catiline conspirators.
Yeah.
People, there's still cars going over it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, their technology was stunning. Our problem is that so much of our wealth and energy is now digitalized and is in cyberspace. So much of our economy has migrated there that we aren't making things of that level of permanence. And a modern skyscraper is concrete, steel, and glass. The glass cracks, the elements get in, vegetation gets in, the concrete cladding is attacked, and once water reaches the, you know, the tubes of steel inside the actual skeleton of the building, they oxidize and expand, the concrete cracks, and the whole thing collapses. So 150 years tops for a modern building. Leave behind?
Well,
really?
That is a great parlor game in some ways. What will survive all of this?
Nappies.
Sad to say, as you describe that in the book, this morass of flotsam and plastic
Caribbean, huge area of floating plastic, and it's still there 800 years on. In my book,
if Churchill was Augustus, is Johnson Caligula?
Well, you know.
Which one is, I mean, what is Boris Johnson?
Well, yes, that is a question that it's hard to answer. I mean, he loves ancient Rome.
He does. And he wrote a very fine book on Churchill.
He's like a sort of tribute, very, very bad Churchill tribute band playing lonely pubs on a Friday night. Can't quite bring it off. A faint echo of what the original was like.
And in terms of imperial comparisons, who would you put him on a par with?
Oh, a certain element of Nero, isn't there? Self-regard and fiddling as the nation burns.
Now, this from a former political editor of The Observer and Labour Party, dare I say it, activist. So when they start writing in to say, you know, stop bashing Boris, he's doing a great job. Stop bashing Trump, he's an extraordinary leader. What's your response to people who feel that you're the part of, you know, the what they call in America, the coastal elite, the intellectual snobs? What do you say to people who say you're alienating people like us?
Well, I think that point's well taken, actually. And nothing is new. I mean, those Cicero books are all about unscrupulous, very wealthy members of the elite themselves mm-hmm. whipping up popular distrust and feeling against the elite of the Senate and bringing it down and the political system collapsing as a result. And, you know, we're seeing something similar to that now. There's a lot of discontent around and they're playing on it quite brilliantly. I facilitated by social media in particular, yes. Obviously with the case of Trump, his tweeting is to death.
You said recently, which was great, you said everything can be known on your phone. And that's why, how do you make historical fiction, or I don't even know if this is science fiction, but whatever it is, it's a genre busting, as I heard somebody describe it recently. And you said it's quite hard. You have to make it feel immediate, like CNN or like a news channel. You've got to keep punching the storyline out. And you posited the idea of Jane Austen novel.
Yeah,
could you share that with us?
Well, it's simply that this access to constant, instant information means that when Mrs. Bennet learned that the smart people had moved in up the road, you know, Mr. Darcy and the rest, she just simply Googled them. So there would have been the story would have been over in the first two sentences.
Google Darcy.
Know. Yeah. One of the great things about writing this novel, actually, yes. set in the future, that is all about technology, is there is no damn technology in it. So everyone's on horseback and it's candlelight and it moves at a stately pace across Exmoor and small villages, and I don't have to grapple with this thing, which is death to a modern detective writer or thriller writer, that everybody knows every damn thing before they leave the room. You know, I used to love those scenes of going to newspaper archives and going through them and gumshoe. You know, no need for it now.
I wonder, do we still need a bit of it? Because if the fake news is cyber, maybe eventually we'll have to return to the physicality of the gumshoe search.
Yeah.
Because we have written down evidence, because everything gets deleted. Whereas if you have to go back to, you know, I'm being hopeful in my...
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think...
Archives and so on.
And in the end, people are people, you know. Everything changes around us, technology, society, the politics. But the basic human instincts, they remain the same, whether it's now or Cicero's Rome, in my view.
Therese has been on. Just some text, Robert Harris, who's live in studio with us this morning. Quick text for Robert, just to say how much I love his books, especially the Cicero trilogy. Couldn't put them down. Looking forward to the Second Sleep for my holidays next month. Great, you're going to love it. Greg says, bought the Second Sleep last Friday after hearing a recommendation of it on your show. I have read several of Robert's books. Was surprised by this one. It was fascinating. Read it on Saturday. Couldn't put it down. Please ask him when the Second Sleep... please ask him when the second sleep, because you do leave it hanging on. I mean, there's got to be more to this.
Yeah, well, oddly enough, it's been optioned by the TV company that made Downton Abbey, and they have an idea that they want to make several series, so that they'll take my novel, which is just set over 6 days, but they will then take the characters and the world and explore
it further.
So that would be good, and I'd be involved in that, and I think No, that's interesting.
There's more to
concept.
Come. No yeah. question about it. Joe in Dublin wants to know, could you ask Robert what Cicero would do about Brexit? Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, what would he have done? There's little doubt he would have been regarded as a member of the elite, if anyone was, Cicero was. And I think that, you know, his whole political shtick was whatever is best for the country, and that a politician, a statesman, was like a doctor, and that their job was to treat the body politic and to do the best to ensure the most happiness and welfare for the majority of the citizens. So, you know, that would have been his course. Having said that, of course, he was highly patriotic and not averse to a bit of tub-thumping himself.
Indeed.
So I wouldn't like to call what he would have said about Brexit.
Barry's in Blackrock, he says, wanted to thank Robert for Fatherland. I thought it was very clever, superb. One of the first books of fiction I read and have recommended it to many. Thanks again. More like that, please. Teresa's in Cork, halfway through The Second Sleep, loving it. Easy to read. And every now and again, I stop and I think, and I need to... I stop and I think, I need to learn how to grow vegetables. Knowledge alters everything, you say in page 62, yet the vested interest blocking the climate change reality is more scary now. Fiction yet again hitting the home truths squarely. Bravo, Robert Harris. How true, says another, those words are about phones and new technology. We've forgotten how to use our primary computer, the brain. And we're all going along with the whole thing. It's madness. Don't forget, some of us are still, says another, out there who don't have a smartphone and aren't on social media. We are not under the malign spell of IT, says Kate. Just bought the book on my phone from Amazon with one-click ordering. The irony, says the text. And another says, Robert is right. I used to be able to impart knowledge to younger people and they would gaze in wonder at my wisdom. Now, no matter what I say, there's always at least one who immediately Googles my pronouncements and challenges their veracity by nitpicking some little aspects. So now I don't bother. It's a bit defeatist.
Yes, that's
a bit defeatist.
Yeah.
But it is. I mean, I drive along the motorway every morning, and my latest thing is to watch bus stops and to see how many heads are down in the phone, and no one's talking to the other person. Yeah. No one's looking out at the world. And I can guarantee you, Robert, if there's six people at a bus stop, there's six heads down.
Yeah, and worse even than that, I think, is when you go to a restaurant and see a family out together for a meal, and almost all of their, again, the heads are bowed as if in prayer over this small device. It's about 5 years ago, I used to hear people saying, put that down, you know, yeah. And that seems to have stopped now because it's like the invasion of the body snatchers. It's got everybody now, even the mum and dad who used to say to the kids, stop doing that. Now they're equally hooked.
Yes.
I find it myself. I mean, I'm not trying to be snooty about it. We're all the same, I think.
Sadly. But I did find in The Second Sleep myself slightly envious of the simplicity of the pastoral life. I did. Like that lady talking about, I want to grow vegetables. Back to your dad and stripping an engine. I think that I'd love to kind of try and re-engage a bit.
Yeah, well, and maybe we'll do that. Maybe there will be a back to nature kind of movement. Will arise in not just out of fears of climate change, but out of... increasing alarm about what the technology is doing to us. It's a hard struggle in this novel in 800 years in the future. You know, life is tough and it's gone back to a kind of, there's no great medicines, there's no, you know, but there is this sense of a small, tight community and that everybody knows everybody. And there's more human interaction, I think.
If I was to talk to you in a year or 18 months, what do you think in terms of Brexit, Britain, Boris, anything else beginning with B?
Yeah, bollocks. I'm allowed to say that. Sorry,
you said
I apologise.
Isn't it funny how that tipped off the tongue?
Yeah, yes.
As a natural quartet.
Yes, it did. I take that back. Forgive me.
Too late.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I think that it's... do you know, it's now 3.5 years nearly since that referendum. Mm. The closer it's supposed to come, the further it recedes. It keeps going back and back and back over the horizon. And the real original sin in this is that the people that won the referendum, the Brexiteers, as a tactic, made a deliberate choice not to say exactly what it was that they wanted. They said, we're just going to issue an instruction to the government. It's not our job to put it into effect. This is what we want. And the truth is, that is totally specious. You can't do that. You've got to say what it is you want. Do you want to be like Norway, or do you want a total break? And they can't make up their own mind. And nobody really, I mean, I say nobody, a third of the country probably is willing to take the hardship and take the severance. But there isn't a majority in the country, and there isn't a majority in Parliament. So unless they start to compromise, I don't think they'll ever get it, quite frankly.
We watch interesting times, to say the very least. Robert Harris, author of The Second Sleep, a marvellous, marvellous book. Loved it so much, and I'm a great fan of what you do. So thanks for coming in to see us this morning.
My pleasure, Ryan. Thanks so much.
Always good to see you. Robert Harris, at 12 minutes to 10, we have more for you after this.